Whether we understood the meaning of the verses was, of course, completely irrelevant. What mattered was that the verses remained engraved in our memory, so we could repeat them at any time. Relatively educated people knew tens of thousands of verses of the law by heart, and doctors of the law knew up to hundreds of thousands. But no one could possibly know the entirety of the law, an oral tradition of millions of verses, which had been transmitted from generation to generation since the creation of the kingdom. Becoming a public servant was an extremely difficult task because it required learning how to face a great variety of situations. For each situation, one had to find the appropriate verse of the law, so the lawful course of action might be taken. That required superior intelligence. Faced with a situation for which no lawful response had been taught, people commonly became blank. They stood motionless with their eyes open, disconnected from reality. As part of the selection process that led to higher education, there were tests that confronted us with new situations or problems. Those who tried to tackle the problem instead of standing still with an absent gaze were considered exceptionally gifted. To pass, they did not even have to solve the problem. This would have required divine inspiration of a level that could not be expected from school children. All they had to do was demonstrate that they did not be cum blank, perhaps by frowning in perplexity, or scratching their head, or even just looking around them. Thank the Lord Melchizedek, I passed. So I was duly taken to a different school. I was to be prepared for a much more difficult exam, the Grand Competition, which recruited the high public servants of the king's administration. This grand competition took place once a year, and was to be undergone at the age of 17 or 18, after 4 years of intense preparation. In this new school, the students, and the teachers, were much sharper, and the classes covered a more varied range of topics. They included history of the law, an easy discipline that explained why and how the law had never changed, the law of the castes, mantric poetry and other lawful arts, Noel-edge of the gods and of the main rituals of the law, but no practice of the ritter-alls, which only priests performed, lawful rhetoric, and even, in the last year, a few lessons of politics. 2.3 How music disappeared from my life. Of all subjects, the one I enjoyed the most was music. As I belonged to a caste of public servants, becoming a musician was not even an option. But had I been more gifted, I would have loved to have taken on music as a recreational occupation, a lawful thing for a public servant to do. But despite all my efforts, I had only limited success in reproducing the rhythms and melodies my teachers played to me. My musical ambitions came to an abrupt end when I was 15. I was saving a lesson from a compassionate teacher who, seeing my genuine aspiration to master a musical instrument, had decided to give me some much-needed private tuition. We were standing in a garden outside the main building of the school. The old man was playing wooden sticks, which were one of the traditional instruments of Atlantean music. Standing in front of me, he was beating the sticks slowly. "This is called monotony," he explained. "It is one of the most profound musical styles we have received from the Lord Melchizedek through the law." Fascinated, I let the rhythm sink deep into me. As he played, he kept on explaining, "The law says, the beauty of music does not lie in that which the ears can hear, but in that which the soul can perceive, and superior musical pieces are those which induce the perception of the harmony of the spheres." After playing in front of me for some time, the old teacher handed the sticks to me, and invited me to imitate him. "Click. Click. No," he said, "try again. Click. Click. No. Try again," he repeated. "Click. Click. No. Try again," he kept saying, and the lawful lesson went on and on. There was no such thing as boredom. Unfortunately, after a lengthy series of attempts, the old teacher decided there was no point continuing, not out of impatience, but from sound judgment. "Perhaps, after all, you would be more successful if we tried a more sophisticated musical instrument," he decided. "Lawfully wait here for me," he said, and went inside. Lawfully waiting was never a problem. I looked up and contemplated the mists, letting my mind become blank. When he came back, he was carrying the most incredibly beautiful instrument I had ever seen. "This one is called Saucepan and Spoon," he said with reverse soft hyphen ends. "It is highly praised by the law." Then he stood in front of me and started playing a magical melody. Bang soft hyphen ting ting, bang 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 soft hyphen ting ting. Never had I heard anything like it. This man was a great artist. Spellbound by his musical harmonies, I was transported so high that I completely lost touch with my physical environment. A vision came to me. But it was elusive, like a mist of faint light among the clouds. It bore some resemblance to a recurrent dream of mine, which I could never quite remember. The music teacher brought me back to reality by pulling my arm. "Would you like to try, Wallon?" Filled with awe, I took the large, heavy saucepan in one hand, and the long spoon in the other. "No," he said, "the spoon must be held with your right hand." After hesitating a moment, I put the large saucepan on the floor, then took the spoon in my right hand, then took the saucepan in my left hand, and then, keeping the bang ting ting tune in my mind, I struck the instrument. Clang. Clang. "No, try again," the old man said. Clang. Clang. There were many attempts. Each time he repeated, "No, try again." After a long period of effort, a miracle took place. Bung. Clang clang. Bung twang. Clang. "Nearly. Try again." The old man's eyes lit up with hope. The sound was so magnificent that once more, I was transported high in the light, and I lost touch with my body. One moment later, however, I was suddenly pulled back into the kingdom by a loud scream of pain coming from my teacher. "Orlon, son of Orlon. You idiot in the law." The old man shouted at me with the corresponding lawful attitude on his face. Looking down, I realized that I had inadvertently dropped the heavy saucepan onto his foot. I scratched my head, looking for an appropriate verse of the law, but could not find any. After this unfortunate episode, I was no longer allowed to study musical in soft hyphen instruments, only singing. But the school's choir masters soon decided that my voice lacked the qualities required to sing the glory of the Lord Melchizedek, and that for the sake of the law, it would be preferable if I focused on the racy soft hyphen tashin of the hymns. 2.4 Growing in the law. Years passed. I grew up in the law. It was a gradual blossoming, a compass soft hyphen eyed by a broadening of my horizons. The law of Melchizedek was not based on restriction. There were no long lists of thou shalt not, linked to punish soft hyphen ments for transgressors. It was exactly the opposite. As one verse said, "By the law, a cobbler can be a cobbler, a shepherd can be a shepherd." The law showed which things were to be done, and when and how to do them. Every action was precisely codified. The more verses one knew, the more one could do. Conversely, those savages who lived on distant shores and knew not of the law were no better than blobs. They spent their days vegetating on the sand, hardly capable of feeding themselves. A topic I particularly enjoyed at school was the law of the castes. It taught which caste wore which color. Each caste wore only one type of clothing. Thank the Lord Melchizedek, this saved them from the nightmare of having to decide what to wear every morning. Thus a learned person could immediately know which caste someone belonged to, just by seeing how they were dressed. Knowing their caste, one could greet them in the appropriate way. The words to salute someone were, "Praise the Lord Melchizedek," to which the other person was to answer, "All glory to the Lord Melchizedek." But the intonation varied totally depending on which caste one belonged to. Thus, for example, the lawfully shrewd cobblers of the southeastern district of the county of Shiring appraised the Lord Melchizedek with a descending quarter tone in the fourth syllable and an ascending half tone in the seventh syllable, while the most lawfully lawful cobblers of the southeastern and eastern districts of the county of Shiring did exactly the opposite, except when they addressed a member of their own caste, in which case the rule was to use as soft hyphen sending quarter tones on all unaccented syllables. But not when addressing an elder, for whom all ascending inflections were to be accentuated. That was Simsoft-Pool. The members of higher castes had much more sophisticated rules, with one particular way of saluting each other caste, and different ways of saluting the members of their own caste depending on the day of the week and the season. There were hundreds of main castes and thousands of sub-castes. This was why the law of the castes was such a fascinating topic of study. Of course, it took years of effort. But what a reward in the end. Whenever interacting with Simsoft-1, there was such profound satisfaction in knowing one could speak to them in exactly the lawful way prescribed by the Lord Melchizedek at the beginning of the kingdom. This privilege, needless to say, was reserved for the members of higher castes. Less educated people only knew a few dozen ways of praising the Lord Melchizedek. To judge someone's level of education, all one had to do was Simsoft-Pool them and listen to the way they answered, "All glory to the Lord Melchizedek." It said everything about their origins. In our later years of schooling, greater and greater emphasis was placed on not becoming blank when faced with a new situation. This goal was to be achieved by gaining a wide perspective on the law, studying many facets rather than just the precepts of one caste, and also through osmosis. In the years of preparation for the grand competition, the teachers were men of a very different caliber from those who took care of young children. They spoke slightly faster, for a start, and a certain light shone in their eyes. They asked many questions, even disconcerting questions for which the students had not yet learned the Simsoft-Pool by heart. And at times they showed a certain sense of humor, a quality almost totally absent from the majority of Atlantean people. To me, the most disconcerting of all topics was politics. It was introduced only in the last year, and was not taken very far. Real political studies began at a later stage and only for those who had succeeded in the grand competition. Thus I never really learned much of this weird art. But the little bit I had to endure Simsoft-Pool remained a topic of wonder to me. The art of politics turned the most fundamental lawful concepts upside down. Normally, when faced with a difficult situation, a learned person would turn to Simsoft-Pool's the wisdom of the law to decide on a course of action. Not so with Simsoft-Pool counselors. Strange as it may sound, their task was exactly the opposite. A prince or high dignitary would approach them with an already made decision. The counselor's task then was to find the verses of the law that best justified that decision. I will always remember my total stupefaction when, during one of my first lectures in politics, a teacher asked me, "The prince of the county of the West Simsoft-Pool Plains has decided to get rid of his wife, who has given him 8 daughters and no sons. Find the reasons in the law which demonstrate that he is right." "Oh my Lord Melchizedek," I exclaimed, "but that is terrible. This woman is going to be Orlon, son of Orlon." The teacher interrupted in an aggravated tone of voice, "These remarks are totally irrelevant. We are here to discuss the law, for the Lord Melchizedek's sake." I sighed and went fishing for a verse from my relatively wide lawful Simsoft-Pool. "A man must fulfill the law of his fathers," I suggested after a moment. The teacher did not seem to be impressed. "A prince commands, and takes orders from no one," another student Simsoft-Pool jested. "Yes." The teacher nodded, "This verse I like much better. The highest duty of a prince is to secure lasting peace in his county. Thus, for the benefit of his subjects, he must have a son, that his son may succeed him on the throne," another student said. "Lawfully excellent." The teacher raised his index finger. "This is exactly what a wise counselor would say. It clearly demonstrates that the prince has no lawful choice but to get rid of his wife." Then he turned towards me, "Now, Orlon, suppose you are advising the prince's wife. How could you demonstrate that the law commands the prince should stay with her?" This time, I was left blank. A major blow had been delivered to my absolute faith in the law. Never before had I suspected that people could play with its sacred truths and manipulate them for personal advantage. This was so contrary to everything I had been taught that all I could do was gaze into the mists and become blank. There was even worse. In some difficult cases, It was not possible to find verses of the law that justified the monarch's decisions. The political advisers then used a mind-boggling technique. They cut parts of lawful verses and re-soft-combined them in such a manner that they fitted the monarch's needs perfectly. And they justified themselves by quoting fundamental verses such as, "That which comes from the law is lawful," or "The law is true, therefore, all parts of the law are true." Thank the Lord Melchizedek, politics was only one of the many subjects we had to study. The law of rituals was much more appealing to me. The village priests impressed me enormously. I was always mesmerized by the chanting of the hymns and the recitations of the mantras of the law. Their vibrant spirit moved me and filled me with wonder. I often followed the village priests when they went to perform rituals soft-signed to maintain the smooth functioning of the forces of nature. These prax soft-tices were aimed at calling down the rain, fostering the fertility of the land, soft-suring the seasons arrived on time, and taking care of the climate in general. As I was not from a priestly caste, I never took part in the chanting, I just sat and watched the rituals. The priests, who in this village wore saffron robes, sat around a small fire, which they lit in a precisely codified manner. Then, chant soft-ing their mantras, they poured oblations into the fire. This created sparks of then soft-urgy in the aura of the flame, which transported me into wonderful, expanded states of consciousness and made me completely lose touch with time. Another caste with which I enjoyed mixing, within the limits imposed by the law, of course, was that of the space controllers. My first encounter with one of them took place after a tragic incident. One morning in my dormitory, a boy was found dead in his bed. He was my best friend, because he slept in the bed next to mine and the law said, "Let thy neighbor be thy friend." I spent the day mourning, lawfully praying for his soul and crying, as prescribed by the verse, "When thy friend dies, pray for his soul and cry for one day, then surrender to the higher wisdom of our Lord Melchizedek." In the afternoon, the village priests were called, and after examining his body they declared his death was not due to some sickness. The boy had simply lost his way during the night. As we were told, this was not an unusual event. In the days that followed, our class was visited by a turn, one of the space controllers in charge of our area. Space controllers were a special caste, whose functions were even more mysterious than those of the priests. They were sometimes called the night shepherds, because they spent their nights traveling through darkness visible, the astral layer closest to the physical world. Their role was to rescue many people who unconsciously wandered too far into astral spaces during their sleep. In a number of cases, without someone to escort them, these stray sheep would have been unable to return into their body, and in the morning they would have been found dead in their bed. The controllers brought them home and sent an impulse to make them wake up. After the death of my school friend, a turn took special care of the boys in my class. Waking up in the morning, I often remembered having met him soft-ing the night. He always thought I was going too far, and when he found me he would tell me off. He thought I was purposely trying to go and explore distant regions of darkness visible, an idea that would have never occurred to me. With time, I learned from him how to spend my nights in the astral neighbor soft-hood, rather than drifting far away. To thank him, I sometimes visited his house during the day and took him flowers. Space controllers were not only loved and appreciated for their service, they also enjoyed great prestige. Many stories circulated about their secret powers, and the strange encounters they sometimes had while traveling in remote astral spaces. When I visited Etern, I used to sit, absorbed for hours, while he talked about his work. He told me about the amazing places he had explored in dark soft-ness visible and the many sleepers he had rescued from certain death. And he spoke of the souls of the dead which he sometimes met on their way to spiritual worlds, worlds so lofty they could not be seen even from the highest levels of darkness visible. He also told me fantastic stories of high priests and priestesses who had traveled even further than him, and explored incredibly distant spheres, at least two or three levels above darkness visible. As he spoke, I sat with my eyes wide open, filled with admiration and awe. Little did I know that I would end up being trained by some of the most PowSoft-Full Space controllers in the kingdom, the White Eagles, women of PhenomeSoft-Null traveling abilities, for whom darkness visible was but a rather dim and unsoft-eventful area located at the bottom of the ladder of the spheres. 2.5 The grand competition. One of the topics which presented me with great difficulty was physical edge-soft-cation. I hated running. The law said that men of my caste were supposed to be able to run so they may serve their sovereign in cases of great emergency, and so I patiently submitted to the classes. But physical exercise, not just running, was deeply against my nature. Perhaps it had to do with the fact that, even though tall, I was extremely thin and particularly vulnerable to all forms of colds and pestilences. Once, in the middle of a sports class which consisted of climbing up and down a stairway, the physical education teacher came over to me. I was sitting on the bottom step, catching my breath, and remembering a PhenomeSoft-Full episode a few months earlier when I had been chased by a cow across an PhenomeSoft-tire field. The man stood in front of me and looked at me for a moment with a strange expression on his face. "You are lucky, Orlon. In our county, public servants never have to take part in war operations. Can you imagine what would happen if you had to fight against the Nephilim giants?" I scratched my head, searching for an appropriate verse. "Fight with spirit, man of the law." "Yes, but spirit comes to the strong, Orlon," he retorted. I nodded, pondering on the depth of that verse. Then he put his hand on my shoulder and said, "He who does well in the grand competition will get a beautiful wife." I frowned, wondering what he meant. "You had better do well, Orlon, son of Orlon," he smiled. "Otherwise I PhenomeSoft-dare what fool of a public servant would want to give you his daughter for a wife?" A wife. I looked up in the mists and became blank. When I came back to myself, the physical education teacher had already gone. After this he never spoke to me again. Most other teachers were much friendlier. In this last year of preparation, they were all trying to awaken a spirit of competition in their students. This was no easy task, especially as far as I was concerned. Once, after a test in history of the law in which I had done quite well, a teacher told me, "Lawfully excellent, or PhenomeSoft-Lon. If you perform like this at the grand competition, you may end up serving the prince of the county of Shiringa himself." I nodded. According to lawful rhetoric, the intonation of his sentence PhenomeSoft-cated that I did not have to look for an answer, just smile politely. "Wouldn't you like to be an important man from whom the royal family itself seeks lawful advice, Orlon?" the teacher asked. I became thoughtful, wondering if I would like that. "You would be rich. You would have a beautiful wife and a large house with servants, and everyone in your native village would respect you," the teacher continued. I remained silent. I hadn't visited my native village for years. I did not even know if my parents were still alive. "Isn't there a position in the high administration of the county of Shiringa you would like to occupy?" he questioned. "Yes," I nodded, "I would like to represent the prince in another county." The teacher had a dubious expression on his face. "Would you really like to travel?" I nodded. Traveling was one of the things Atlantean people usually hated the most. It not only implied leaving the comfort of their home, but also adapting to a new climate, and sometimes even to a different lifestyle. Still, for some strange reason it appealed to me. "Well, in that case, Orlon, you must do well in the grand competition," the teacher tried to impress on me. "The prince does not appoint many PhenomeSoft-doors." I put on a decided face, as lawful rhetoric dictated I should after receiving an injunction of this kind. But the need to reach a high score at the grand competition was not as obvious to me as it was to some other students, who seemed to be anxious to join the high ranks of the royal administration. In the months that preceded the grand competition, many of my fellow PhenomeSoft-dents started showing signs of excitement. It all remained lawfully moderate, but still, there was no doubt that the prospect of undergoing the critical tests was having an impact on them. They started discussing topics that would never have come to their mind beforehand, such as which positions they wished to reach, and what sort of lawful spouse they would like. When talking, They tended to use fewer stock phrases, and they chose their verses of the law with more wit. Some of them, whose ambition seemed staggering to me, even studied after classes or engaged in debates, polishing their rhetoric for the examinations. Finally, the great event arrived. The competition was to take place in Shiringa City, the capital of the county, where hundreds of students coming from all corners of the county flocked every year. A few days before leaving the boarding school, a large ceremony took place, during which the students lawfully expressed their gratitude for what they had received from their teachers. A team of priests came and sang hymns for a few hours. Then the teachers all stood in a row, and each student, one after the other, came and thanked each teacher by repeating the same appropriate verses of the law, which were pronounced in the reserved but moderately sad tone. Needless to say, the Lord Melchizedek was copiously praised before, during and after this lawfully moving exchange. The students also thanked the energies of the land and the trees for their nurturing support. Finally, they thanked each other, and the ceremony finished with a lawful banquet during which all were invited to rejoice about the beautiful years ahead of them, repeating the model of their elders for the greatest glory of our Lord Melchizedek. What more envy-soft-able destiny could they have dreamt of? Blissful sleepers! Little did they suspect their world was about to collapse. Thus ends the Book of the Blissful Sleepers. 3. The Book of the Call of Destiny. 3.1 The Call of Destiny. The grand competition consisted of four parts. In the first part, candidates had to undergo various examinations. They were to demonstrate their null-soft-edge of the law and engage in long recitations of hymns, none of which pre-soft-scented much difficulty for those who had been properly prepared. Then the con-soft-didacts were submitted to a fire of questions relating to practical situations likely to be encountered by public servants, and to the application of various rules and pieces of legislation. Each time, the challenge was to find a verse of the law that shed light on the problem and suggested a course of action. Quite unexpectedly, I found myself enjoying the whole exercise, much more than the months of preparation that had led to it. Unlike some of my fellow stew-soft-dents, I had little motivation to become part of the high administration of my county. I wanted to make sure I would never have to run, and keep away at all costs from anything that had to do with cattle. Apart from this, I did not really care whether I ended up being a grand intendant of lawfully pending admin soft-estrative implementations, a lower attaché of lawful princely representation, or a lawful whatever else. Not preoccupied with achieving a high score, my mood was serene. I surrendered to the higher wisdom of our Lord Melchizedek, placing my destiny in his hands. But as the days passed, I enjoyed the vibrant atmosphere of the examination rooms more and more. The examiners were sharp-witted and they conveyed a certain alertness that not only helped me think clearly, but also made me feel more alive than ever before. So at the conclusion of the first week, when I learned that I was not one of the 1,200 candidates who had been eliminated, I was genuinely happy. I was curious, lawfully mildly curious, to see what would happen during the rest of the competition. The second part was not only supposed to be the most difficult, but also the most crucial of the whole selection process. Of the 600 remaining con-soft-didacts, only 100 would qualify for the third stage of the competition. The trial took place in a neighboring forest. It was to last all day. The candy-soft-dates were separated into small groups, the goal being to reach a certain place hidden in the woods. To find our way, we had to go through a number of checkpoints where we were asked questions, and given directions according to the accuracy of our answers. The race started at dawn and finished at midnight. We had been warned that many candidates would not make it to the final ren-soft-divis. Furthermore, some of us might well lose our life when we encountered the fierce guardians that kept the small bridges spanning many water streams that ran through the forest. Thus my young friends regarded this race as the trial of their life, the single major event which would seal their destiny. Lawfully anxious, I began the race at dawn. I was part of a group which in soft hyphen included five of my school friends. We were but one of 100 such groups, made up of students from several schools in the county, and of others who had come to compete, trying to secure a bright future for themselves. We began our trail on the edge of the forest and went looking for the first of the checkpoints. We had only been walking for half an hour when a voice called us. "Hey."
"Yes, I'm calling your lawful selves,"